Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on the New Books in Intellectual History, we have Dr. Graham Russell Gow Hodges, who is the George Langdon Jr. Professor of History in Africana and Latin American Studies at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York, and the author of several books on the history of African Americans in New Jersey, including more recently, The Marion Thompson Wright Reader, published by Rutgers University Press in 2022. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you, Hetty. Very my pleasure to be with you.
So glad you can join me today. So today on New Books in Intellectual History, we are going to discuss The Marion Thompson Wright Reader. It's the first book-length project on the noted historian Dr. Marion Thompson Wright, the first African-American woman to secure a PhD in history from a U.S. institution of higher education. The Reader contains a biographical essay on Wright and also her published dissertation on the education of Negroes in New Jersey, published by Columbia University Press in 1941. First, we will discuss Dr. Hodges' biography, research and teaching interests, and some thoughts on intellectual history in general. Then we will engage in a more in-depth discussion of the Marion Thompson Wright Reader. So Dr. Hodges, tell us some more about your teaching and research interests.
Thank you. I've been teaching at Colgate University now for over 35 years. My bread and butter is early American history up to 1877, with a heavy dose of African-American history because that's been one of my major fields of interest. I also teach Asian-American history because I've done some work in that. And, of course, New York City history because that's where I started and New York City is my muse. So those are the things that I teach. And over the course of the last few decades, I've been fortunate enough to publish a number of books. I did a biography of Anna Mae Wong. I did a book on taxicab drivers because I drove a cab 5 years earlier in life. My dissertation was done on New York City cartmen, who were the ancestors of the cab drivers. And I've also done a fair amount of books on African Americans in New York and New Jersey. Beginning with my book on Monmouth County, on slavery and freedom in Monmouth County, which published in 1997. And I think I'll be doing a new edition of that within the next year because it's been some very interesting stuff that's come out in the last quarter century. I also do a book called Root and Branch, called African Americans in New York and East Jersey, 1613 to 1863. And more recently, a book on called Black New Jersey. And that's where I learned more about Marion Thompson Wright. And this has happened to be before in my career that I decided that someone I did in a broad survey of Black history was worth further examination. For example, I did a biography of David Ruggles, a Black abolitionist and conductor of the Underground Railroad in New York City, a person who helped save Frederick Douglass. And so Marion Thompson writes, the Reader is sort of in that line. She's somebody that people know a fair amount about. At least the broad outlines of her career. Her book is justly famous. It's cited by pretty much everybody who works on Black New Jersey or also on early Black education, but not much is known about her life and the extent of her career. And so, again, building off what I had done earlier, I decided that a fuller treatment of her was in store, and that's what I've done.
Yes, it definitely was in store. I just, because this is really the first book-length project on her. I mean, like you say, she's cited by everyone who does African-American history in New Jersey. There are some journal articles and I think a few book chapters about her. But no, you know, full length book she, until your
if
book.
If I may, I just didn't see. She is a real hero to Black women intellectual historians. She's someone, you know, she is a first. She was the first Black woman to get a PhD in the discipline of history. She got at Columbia University and then was published, as you mentioned, a year later. And she's also, you know, she's a forerunner, a pioneer in a lot of ways. And so many people, I think yourself included, look upon her as a kind of a progenitor of your career and of she's an example to many people. So, yeah, she definitely needs a further examination.
Yeah, I think so. This is a question. I want to just backtrack for a minute because I've had this conversation with people about how to define her as a historian, social worker, social scientist. And how would you define her as an intellectual? Is she clearly in one field or is she straddling multiple fields or is it clear for one or the other?
I think they're all true. I think she does straddle multiple careers. And she, in her teaching, she was very interested in counseling. She established student counseling at Howard University, where she taught for about 30 years. She was particularly interested in the average student. She said everybody pays attention to the students of excellence, but the ordinary students need some attention as well. But back to your question, I thought about this. You know, she's published in the Journal of Negro History. She has two very large articles, which are printed in this new compilation that I made. That's the Journal of Negro History. So clearly Carter Woodson considered her to be a historian. I think of that right in itself says an awful lot. She got an award for the best book review in the Journal of Negro History. So again, you know, there are people at the time who, even though she was in the education department, who regarded her clearly as an historian. And she's referred to frequently that way. When she signs on in the early 1950s to help out in the brief for the Brown versus Board of Education, she's hired because of her talents and her skills as an historian to research the integration of schools right after the Civil War. So, I mean, the people at the time saw her as an historian, and the fact that she was a social worker for a while, that she taught in the education department at Howard, that should not blind us to her full talents as an historian. That's how I see her, and I think that, again, I'm just hearkening back to what Carter Woodson and other people felt about her when she was during her time.
Yeah, I agree with you, and it's because, again, where she's publishing and how she sees herself, you know, or how she defines herself as an intellectual, she worked under Merle Curdy, right? You know,
yes, she did.
I think he's her dissertation advisor, right?
Yeah. Merle Curdy, for those of you who are not familiar with him, was a white historian who taught at Columbia University and later went to the University of Wisconsin, widely known, revered, and respected. And this guy was at really a top caliber historian. And he took Marion Thompson Wright on as his student and worked with her and made sure that she got the dissertation done and then got it published by Columbia University Press. So you're quite right to prompt me on that. Here is a major American historian for whom Marion Thompson was one of his prime students. And again, that just shows you how people regarded her at the time. Woodson and Curdy, that's hard to think of people of more capability and stature than that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. So let's talk about the book more directly. Tell us about the structure and content of the book as a whole, and then we'll get into some more specific details.
Sure. The book is divided into really just two large sections. The first is a 75-page biography that I've made of her, both of her career as an academic and also her personal life, of which there was a great deal of sadness. So that's the first part of the book. I also have an introduction which talks about her importance and some of the past work that's been done on her. Then we go directly into her work because this is really what Rutgers wanted me to do. They really want me to get a kind of a one stop that everybody could go and find very good work on Marion Thompson Wright. So we have a modern reprint of her book. And I think they did a terrific job. I was really very impressed when I got the book and how that they take a 1940s font and transferred it flawlessly into our contemporary font. It's nice, big lettering. It's easy to read. And so we have the fullness of her book right within this compilation. Then I also wanted to have some of her articles. And so there are a couple of articles in the Journal of Negro History, one on New Jersey and Negroes and laws, and the other one, which is on education again. And then following that, there's also another one on integration in New Jersey that she published in the Journal of Negro Education. And this is important because she was the book review editor of the Journal of Negro Education for about 30 years. And so following that, I have a couple of her book reviews. She also did something called notes for the Journal of Negro Education. And these are really interesting because they're kind of like review essays. Sometimes it'd be as long as 10 or 15 pages of recent books, pamphlets, articles, whatever she felt was important within a particular kind of theme. And she published these things in the JNE. To me, it was kind of amazing because she's doing this like once or twice a year. And these are really significant articles. And so there are a couple of those. And then finally, there is the encyclopedia entry that she did for an early Encyclopedia of American Women. And she did hers on Lucy Diggs Slow. And Slow is a very important person. She was the first dean of women at Howard University. Marion Thompson Wright was a protege of hers. Wright, like everyone else, adored Lucy Diggs Slow, supported her in her fights with Mordecai Johnson, who was the college president, and mourned her when she died early in 1937. So towards the end of her career, Marion Thompson Wright, and again, this speaks to her abilities as an historian, wanted to do a biography of Slow. And so that last entry in there is this two-page encyclopedia entry on Slow, which remains a very important document on her. It was superseded by a biography that was done about 10 years ago by Carol Moody and others. This is a very good piece on Slow. And then finally, the book contains a full chronological bibliography of everything that Marion Thompson Wright published. And this can include very famous articles in the Journal of Negro History. She did things for her sorority. Did things for a variety of Quaker magazines. She did things in the New Jersey Herald. That's a full compilation or bibliography of her work. And so that's what's in there. There's also a lot of interesting photographs in the book of not only of her own work, but also of Howard University, where she taught for 30 years, and also of her personal life, of her family, her parents, her sisters, her sister, her son and her daughter, to give us a much fuller understanding of what Marion Thompson Wright was about.
Yeah, so much needed, I think, and it's going to be very useful to scholars of not only New Jersey history, but I think the civil rights movement, Black women's intellectual history. I think such an important text. Give us some more insight into Wright's personal biography. As you detail in your biographical essay in the book, let's start there.
Okay, let's begin with her academic life. Marion Thompson Wright studies at Howard University from 1927 through 1928 when she gets a BA and an MA. And she works there under leading scholars in the education department. She left Howard for a while, then returned in 1940 to become an assistant professor with a book, and then remained there until her death in 1962. And during that time, I think that she epitomizes, and she's an early example of this, of the Black woman's experience in the academy. Howard University's education department and its history department were really the equals of any university department in the nation at the time. And there were some real heavy hitters in both departments. And so, you know, she was part of a an extraordinary academic environment at Howard during the mid-century. So, I mean, I do detail, you know, her progress or as an academic from assistant professor to full, the many committees that she served on, her work as a counselor, her attendance at not only a Black academic conventions, but also, you know, going to the American Historical Association and seeing W.E.B. Du Bois present the first panel on Blacks that have been done in about 30 years. This is 1940s, a very significant moment. And she continues to go to these kind of conferences. So as an academic, she lived the kind of full experience that we all hope to enjoy. She wasn't happy with it, which is hardly surprising. Academics are known to complain about things. And she did feel slighted as a Black woman, that she did not get some of the benefits that her male counterparts did. But there's no question that she had a very full academic experience. That said, and this gets to the second part of what I disclose in this biography, you know, she had a life of tension and anguish and anxiety. And that comes from her early life, events that continued to resonate throughout the rest of her life. And that is that when Marion Thompson Wright was a teenager, she was an outstanding student at what was then called Newark High School, now called Barringer. And then and she's a junior, she drops out very suddenly in the middle of the year. And the reason for that is explained a couple of weeks later when she gets married to a laborer named James Moss and they have their first child, a daughter. And then a year later, she has another child. So by the time that she's 18 years old, she's married with two children and does not have a high school diploma. This would condemn her into a life of domesticity at best. Her mother had worked as a domestic for wealthy families in Montclair and knew that this kind of position was very unsatisfying. It's been often akin to a form of slavery, certainly not much above that. And that's what Marion Thompson Wright was facing, that her life would be, at best, the same kind of drudgery that her mother and thousands of other Black women were experiencing at the time. Very limited, tense, having to be servile, working for lesser wages. And neither she or her mother wanted that for her. So she made a very dramatic decision at the age of 18, and that is she left her family. And she moved back with her mother first and eventually returned to high school, graduated in about a year and a half as a distinguished student. She was, they didn't have valedictorians there, but she was certainly close to the top of the students at Newark High School, and subsequently was admitted to Howard University with a scholarship. And so she's one of three Black students at Newark High School who went on. And Newark High School at that time was really good. I mean, white male students routinely went to Princeton, Yale. The white women went to Wellesley, Smith, and those kind of places. But Marion Thompson Wright wanted to go to Howard. The problem was this, is that Howard University at the time did not want to admit women with children or married women, and she was both. So she disguised the fact that she had a family, entered as a single, presumably chaste woman, and lived in the dormitory. And so she was always anxious that someone would uncover and disclose the truth about her. And given the mores at the time, had that occurred, she would have been expelled immediately. So she's always living with this deep worry that her life back in Newark will be uncovered. During this time, her husband contacted her, asked her to return. She refused. He subsequently sued for divorce and got full custody of the children. And this is very unusual because the default position, I think, of American judges is simply to, in a divorce case, is to award the children to the mother. And so for Marion Thompson Wright to be deprived of contact with her children was a deeply damaging, wounding experience. And as she said to her son in a later letter, and I use this as an epigraph in the book, it's something that really struck me hard. She said, "What would you have done in the circumstances if you were in my place?" Okay. And she had an opportunity to go on to a career, to be a student, to fulfill her dreams, or she could stay at home with her two children and become a domestic. And she had an iron rod of ambition. So she chose to go to Howard and had to live with this, not only during the time when she was a student. And there were moments when she was very close to being exposed, but also after she returned to Howard as a professor. Because had Mordecai Johnson, the president of the university, found out about her deception, she would have been fired from her job immediately. So until the time of her death, she first refused to let anyone know about the children. Then when the truth came out, her friends, and this includes people like Theodosia Daniel, who was basically her best friend. This is a woman who had been a student of hers in the 20s, later married Walter Daniel, who was a very distinguished member of the education department. And she and Wright traveled together. They went to Europe. They went to sorority conventions across the country together. And Theodosia Daniel knew that she would never mention these children to Marion Thompson Wright. So, I mean, this is somebody who, again, was her very best friend and knew not to say anything about it. And even when she began to have a rapprochement with her children, when they were adults, they also knew not to disclose their relationship with her mother. So on the one hand, she's a very successful academic. Now, she's someone with a lot of publications. She's widely respected. She's called upon to serve on major research interests that will eventually benefit the nation and transform our society. Okay. At the other hand, she's someone who has a deep secret that she cannot disclose. And eventually that's what caused a powerful depression to wave over her. And she ended her own life at the age of 61 in 1962. So, I mean, this is a very sad aspect about her. And I explore this very fully in the biography, that there was this mutuality. On the one hand, there's this public success, but there's this deep sadness, tragedy, and powerful deception.
So yeah, let's talk about that for a minute, because I know, as I said, there's no biography of her beyond this. This is the most extensive biography of her, this section in your book, that exists as far as I'm aware, beyond, you know, a journal article or two.
It is. I can tell you that. I've looked at everything. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, so I was going to say, because I've seen, you know, articles where individuals are kind of arguing around whether or not she took her own life, and that's controversial for some people, at least in more dated articles that I've read. You know, this is going back a few years. Why do you suppose, because there's a news article that is published and it describes, you know, how she was found. Yes. You know, by her two friends who came and found her. So why do you suppose do you think it was a matter of not having the sources, and the people that were writing these journal articles or book chapters just didn't have that information? Or is there something else at play here in terms of maybe a type of respectability politics?
It's possible that was a matter. I mean, suicide is never a pleasant subject. And I don't think that there was any attempt at the time. Walter Daniel did a wonderful tribute to her in the Journal of Negro Education the following year after her death. And he indicated that. I mean, he's one of the guys that found her in her car. She had killed herself through used monoxide from her car. There was no doubt about this, at the time. So I think, you know, she didn't have any enemies in particular who would, you know, do her harm. I don't think there's ever any suggestion of that.
Right.
And she also had talked about this earlier. She even talked about in a Sunday school class at Plymouth Congregational Church that she wished she would go to sleep and never wake up again. And this was very shocking to people. She had attempted suicide once before with pills and was resuscitated. She did kill herself. That's the harsh, bald fact about it. The tragedy, of course, is, you know, the deception that kept her from being what she really was, which is trying to be a loving mother, at the same time having this very demanding and successful career.
Yeah. In reading some of her letters to her son, because she was a prolific letter writer, and one of the questions I have, too, is probably about why not have some of those letters in the reader, but I came across one of her letters to her son, and it seems as if this is not a letter to her, but to someone else he's writing about why did she do this, and then scribbled on the side where I think he's saying something along the lines that I just don't understand, why would somebody do this? And it's to one of her friends, you know, he's kind of quizzing or asking the friend, like, why?
I think that's a natural question, especially for someone who was as close to her as James Allen Moss was. I mean, they had their hard times when he was growing up. She wasn't allowed to see them. Remember, you know, her husband has full custody, and he and his next wife didn't want her around. And I was told by one of her descendants that occasionally Marion Thompson Wright would watch her children play in a playground from a car, and she wouldn't approach them. So, I mean, there were some really tough times between her and her children. And later on, James Allen Moss, you know, really, you know, he was pretty angry with her. And they did have their tense moments. Gradually, they began to have a rapprochement, and, you know, his children wrote her at Christmas time. She sent them presents. So there was contact, the kind of contact you would expect between a grandmother and her grandchildren. And certainly James Allen Moss, you know, he's a very interesting character. You know, he's raised in a household by someone who did not finish ninth grade, but he became an outstanding student. Eventually got a PhD at Columbia University in 1957, clearly modeled himself after his mother. Mm-hmm. You know, he talked with her about getting things published. He spoke about his ambitions with her, you know, but at the same time, there was still a kind of a distance with her. He would refer to her as Marion rather than as mother.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, so, and after committed suicide, I think the most poignant comment he made is, you know, she'd hung in there a little bit longer, she would have realized just how well things turned out, and she didn't have to feel sad and tragic about it. But, you know, what goes on in the mind of somebody who is young like she was, I mean, she was only 60 years old, and had a good career and a great project. I mean, the Lucy Digslow biography would have been a wonderful way for her to continue her scholarship. And she got support from a newspaper in Washington. They gave her $2,500 to pursue her work. She had sabbatical from Howard. I mean, you know, everything was in place. Right. But her personal tragedy just overcame her. And this is the kind of depression which, if untreated, and it was with her, you know, we'll kill someone.
Yeah. But nonetheless, despite it all, her contributions to the field of history, to social work, social sciences more generally, I think your reader speaks to as well, you know, beyond her biography. And, you know, I think even just thinking about in a patriarchal society, what women must go through to live an intellectual life, a life of the mind. And I think her story sort of speaks to those struggles a great deal.
I'm a white male, so it's presumptuous of me to speak about what Black women think or feel. But my guess is, that this is someone who struggled. And she, of course, she was, it was there's even less acceptance then. There can be an argument about that made certainly today. But I mean, she was working in a very tough environment, and she did make some outstanding intellectual contributions. I mean, her work on the relationship of the Society of Friends and abolitionism and early education, this stuff is, we're still working out of that. You know, it's still a very, very important theme. You can see this in Manisha Sinha's recent book on the history of abolition. I mean, her stuff really stands up well. Her periodization of Black life in New Jersey and the North is something that's still very, very good. Her book, I think, you know, it's a source which is still can be mined very successfully. And, you know, to have that said about a book that's 70 years old, that's not bad.
Yeah, let's talk some more about her intellectual contributions, and specifically the contribution she makes to the history of African Americans in New Jersey. You know, in her dissertations, in her the other writings that you have in the Reader, and how she comes to be on the Brown versus Board team to do historical research for litigation.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I mean, one of her first contributions is to show the importance of the Society of Friends with Black life in early New Jersey. Now, this is in itself is an advance because the earlier books that have been done on Black life and slavery in New Jersey, well, really about slavery, and it was institutional, it was how slavery worked, what were the laws for it, how did slave masters work? Well, she talks about how Black people interacted with friends, with Quakers, but also with political figures. She talks about the growth of a free Black class during the antebellum period, about the growth of Black politics. I mean, these things, you know, the people are just now beginning to really embrace the fact that there was such a thing. And, you know, she's doing it 70 years ago. You know, her work on the American Revolution could be a little bit larger, I think, but it's still credible. And then she talks really very importantly about the Reconstruction period and the growth of Black choices in education, the time of Jim Crow. But again, this is something about her that anticipates later events. She was an optimist. She was somebody who thinks that, this again, during a time of Jim Crow, this is New Jersey, 1940, there are a lot of laws and customs in New Jersey that kept Blacks and whites apart. Okay? There are no Black scholars at places like Rutgers or Princeton. You know, she is an optimist, despite a lot of evidence to the contrary, about how things are going to go. And that's what she devotes her life to. She's very much of an integrationist. And all of her work lends itself towards that. And her son disagreed with her. He was much more pessimistic about how American life would be. And he, you know, grew up during the 1950s, 1960s, a very active Black power guy. But I mean, for her, there was always that movement towards something better. And that's what she tried to glean out of history. And that's significant. She was not Pollyannish about this. She recognized that there have been barriers. She recognized that there have been troubles. She recognized the damages of slavery. But she said that this is a way that Black people in New Jersey are trying to push ahead and do better. And that's the kind of scholarship I think eventually attracted that into the thoroughness of her scholarship. I mean, she really, her footnotes, her sources, they're very full, very admirable. That's the kind of thing that would attract Thurgood Marshall and the rest of the team working on Brown versus Board of Education in the early 1950s, why they wanted her as a researcher, because they felt that she was so good that she would be able to look at those Southern Reconstruction constitutions and education programs and decide, you know, whether or not there had been an attempt to integrate after the Civil War. Ultimately, that becomes kind of a small part of the overall brief, although it's about five or six pages of it, and she is credited in it. But I mean, she's somebody, you know, who wanted to push for integration to have a greater fullness of New Jersey and Black life in general.
Yeah, talk to us a little bit more about what's happening in terms of New Jersey in the 40s and the civil rights laws that are coming into place, but also the Constitution, right? New Jersey Constitution in 47. And like, she's right in the middle of all of that. And you know, as she's doing her research, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. New Jersey was a very conservative state. It's the last of the northern states to adapt gradual emancipation. In 1804, there are still enslaved people, quasi-slaves in the 1850s. My book on Monmouth County, I was amazed to see a runaway ad in 1857. I mean, this is just before the Civil War. And allegedly, there were no enslaved people at that point. They were apprentices, but here's a master wants his enslaved person back. And, you know, this is kind of incredible. So New Jersey does not vote for Lincoln on either election. New Jersey does, the legislature does not support either any of the three amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. It has freedom imposed upon it. And so it's a very conservative state headed by the Democratic Party, which retains power in the state into the 20th century. And this is the old Democratic Party. Now things have been completely reversed now, and Black people support the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party is now the party of repression and I think a kind of a new Jim Crow. But at any rate, so over the course of the 20th century, the Black middle class, and I talk about a lot of this in my book, Black New Jersey, is profoundly Republican. This is the party of Lincoln. This is a party where they can gain some kind of edge. Okay? And they continue with that. And so this is the case even as late as the 1960s, that there will be Black New Jerseyans who are Republicans. And finally, Goldwater kind of pushes them out then, and Nixon's sort of the last straw. There's a milieu in which the Republican Party is pro-Black. And so to maintain that, there's legislation put forth in the 40s to give greater civil rights, particularly in education, to African Americans. And this is the kind of thing that Marion Thompson Wright's work was really important towards gaining. I mean, she, you know, her work is the source for all that kind of legislation. And so she is someone people look to for information on this. New Jersey continues to be conservative. I mean, in case you can make an argument, it always has been. Mm-hmm. Certainly now there are more Black mayors, and there we have a lieutenant governor who's Black, and Cory Booker, of course, a U.S. senator who is, as he put it a couple of days ago, the fourth popularly elected Black senator in our history. New Jersey has some progress, but still, of course, there's a long way to go. In the 1940s, there was much, much further to go. It's still kind of a Jim Crow society. But the Republican Party with Black allies are chipping away at that. And so they're creating laws and commissions to support those laws, which are really in advance of anything else in the country.
Yeah. And she's right in the middle of it. And her work, the thing, I think, you know, you say she's an optimist, but I think she sees many respects, her ideas being applied in the case in Trenton, for instance. You know, that's like 3 years after her dissertation is published in the NAACP Lawyers in Trenton and then the Hedgepeth Williams case. Like, yeah. She's able to see the application of ideas in action, which probably would have gave her that, you know, enhanced her optimism.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, she again, I said she's not Pollyanna. She's someone who has an optimism which is undergirded with a very powerful understanding and depth of history. So, yeah, that's a good point you're making, that the Hedgepeth case is an example where her ideas are beginning to put into practice, and that continues through the 1940s. I mean, she's the person they call on whenever they want further information on this. She's the great expert. It's kind of remarkable, and I talk about this. You know, and she has an article in New Jersey Laws published in the Journal of Negro History. The year that she won, the JNH also published articles by John Hope Franklin and Kenneth Stamp, both of whom today are regarded as giants of American history. And certainly Franklin's textbook, which he published in 1946, and he and Wright were close friends. This is something that's really important, but she was their peer during the 1940s. She had published important work. It was recognized by people in her field. It's also, as I think you pointed out, recognized by political and legal experts in New Jersey. She's called upon continually as someone to provide information and testimony. She's a significant figure. And, I hope I brought that out successfully in my biographical introduction. This is somebody, who really had a lot to say during her time.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And at least in her professional life, she had room to be optimistic and see her ideas be applied, which is rare. I mean, for a scholar, I think even now, to see that she's sought after and that she has a level of respect. And I think despite it all, she made these lasting contributions to African-American history and the history of New Jersey, women's history. Has she been able to complete that biography of Lucy Diggs Slough? I think just would have been another area in which she was still, making great contributions.
I think you're quite right. I mean, had she lived and finished that book at the time, it would have been a real pioneering work. And Slough, for anybody in the audience who doesn't know much about her, was a very significant figure at Howard and nationally among Black women and within education generally. So it would have had, that book would have made a big splash had she finished it. And probably would have, if she don't, the rest of her family lived fairly long. They lived quite significantly longer than she did. I think there was some longevity there. So, she would have had probably other things to do as well. And that's why it's a tragedy that her personal circumstances doomed her. Mm. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good point that biography would have done a lot for her and for the rest of us.
So as we come to the conclusion of our show, what is next for you in terms of writing, research, teaching?
Yeah, well, I have a couple of things in the fire. I have a big book on the Black Flight in the Americas from 1500 to 1877, which I'm pecking away at. But right now I'm working on a memoir which includes chapters on my parents. For those of you who don't know me, I'm an older father. My sons will not be mature and interested in their family until I've left this world, probably. So it's important I get this down. And just apropos of what we're talking about now, my father is from Mississippi. He went to Ole Miss. And then subsequently, in the late 30s, he encountered Willis Weatherford, who's probably a forgotten name, but Marion Thompson Wright certainly would have known who he was. And this is a guy who was a white man, a gradualist in race relations, but someone who wanted Blacks and whites to work together. And he founded something called the Blue Ridge Movement in North Carolina, and also a YMCA movement in Nashville, both of which my father took part, in which Blacks and whites worked together. So when my father was at Blue Ridge one summer, Weatherford brought in George Washington Carver. Okay, Benjamin Mays came, and they had dinner together. And this is in the South in 1938. Okay? So my father, who comes from Mississippi, which is, I think Rayford Logan described it well, as the nadir of race relations, probably the worst places in the world, learned there as a young adult to work and to deal with African-Americans. I think this is really important. And then subsequently, my father and also Weatherford's son went up to Yale Divinity School where they studied under Richard Niebuhr, who was one of the leading pacifists in the country in the beginning of World War II. My father, who had a clerical deferment, rejected it and went in and did 5 years of alternate service as a conscientious objector. So I'm really interested in the kind of ideas that were percolating at the time. And so I find that here's a guy from Mississippi who otherwise probably would have been just an ordinary Methodist minister, but became deeply engaged in civil rights and in pacifism as a result of his exposure to Black people, both at Blue Ridge and also at Yale. And I kind of think that it somehow influenced me in some ways, if I can be so modest. So that's what I'm working on. And it's really a fascinating thing to deal with and to also place your parents and my own life within historical context. So I'm trying to finish it up in the next few months. We do two versions. One is a big extra illustrated version for my family. And the other will be something I'm going to try to publish. And I've got a couple of feelers out there, so we'll see what happens.
Sounds very interesting. And I want to thank you for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure.